the comments on the right hand side there. And if at any point you've got a question or something else you just want to bring up for funsies, feel free. We may even address it. Here with me is Molly Tanzer, the magnificent author of our new Jor-El story, First in 85 Years, and Kevin Beckett, our social media maven, who is keeping an eye on all the technical side of things and making sure we don't bloop out or whatever. So as people show up here, Molly, I believe you were just looking at alpacas. How sword and sorcery would you say alpacas are?
I'd say they're more metal than sword and sorcery. Like, I don't know, like they have big hair and they're smaller. They're always smaller than I remember. Like, they're not like llamas. You're not like, oh, they're like shorter than you. so they're ridiculous. And the babies are really cute. So I don't know how sword and sorcery they are.
Fair enough.
I don't feel like these are particularly mighty. So.
Now, the comment about babies, I'm just imagining the little baby heavy metal musicians, like diapers, but with like the big hair and everything. Like, that's pretty good. Cool.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm down to that. what else? While we're waiting for, give people a few more minutes here to show up. You've done your story. That's one very nice thing about our whole setup here. I think we're waiting for final copy edits, but whatever. Like, the story's done. It's been written. It's ready to go. Huzzah. I'm looking forward to showing it to the artist and getting cracking on that. The artist being Saprophile, for those who are familiar with issue 2 last year. She illustrated Gemma Files' story, Revelstoke, and also illustrated the Jor-El Jurie, it's called Black Glass Kiss, TTRPG setting. So that's pretty cool. We're getting a good, connect the dots here with Jor-El and art. You've had that story in the can for a little while from your POV. What are you currently working on, if you're allowed to discuss it?
Oh, what am I currently working on? I am finishing some edits for I'm finishing edits for an unannounced, exciting thing that I will have signed the contract for imminently, but before then cannot discuss. But I'll have like a new book out sometime soon, which is really nice. And in hardcover, which is, I don't think I've ever had anything come out in hardcover. I'm working on some of that. And then I'm also starting up, I'm finishing up edits on my novel. I'm sort of talking in talks with my agent on what she wants to see from it and what I can do to kind of meet her in the places that she wants. And then I've got a couple of short pieces that I'm working on. I'm working on a story for an anthology and then also one for pleasure. So I've got a lot of irons in the fire right now.
Writing for pleasure, strange. Yeah.
I know. One of my goals was to write a story just for pleasure, not for an anthology, not for a call, not for a reason, but just because I wanted to. So I'm getting an earlier start on that than I thought, but I had an idea.
Nice. Are you letting yourself like do the kinds of things you wouldn't normally do if you're writing, for an anthology or something? Or
I don't know. I don't know if my behavior, that's interesting. The story often, I think, there's two kinds of anthologies. There's ones that are like overly broad and the ones that are like overly specific. And this one is I wouldn't say it's overly specific. It's very specific. And so like there are things that needed to be in the story. And, that is fun to do because it's like working in sort of a framework. Whereas I got inspired for the story listening to like an obscure Scottish 80s song by the band Orange Juice, which is not usually how I get my ideas, but it's a pretty rockin' song. And so I was like, oh, this is weird. This sounds like a story that I might write. And so I did.
Well, that's cool. And just one last little question before we get into the interview proper. Do you find that you write to music or is it too distracting? Do you have playlists for projects?
I will sometimes put on like lo-fi. I am, technically a millennial. So I do like the steady lo-fi beats for work / study 24/7, like those playlists. But often I will put on ambient soundscapes of, sometimes I try to align them with what I'm writing on, but sometimes I'll just put on like a thunderstorm. There's a lot of really cool things like that on YouTube where it's like 10 hours of a rainstorm in a forest or 10 hours of a soundscape, cyberpunk city or
It's like an animated GIF, like someone with a backpack chilling out, looking out a window.
Sometimes the cyberpunk one definitely has like a flying car that's like vroom, like every once in a while. I guess that's what makes it cyberpunk, you know, is like a flying car with a vroom sound. But I don't know, the nature ones usually blend in more, and I don't feel like I'm using any part of my brain except for what I'm working on. It's not like listening to a lyric or thinking, oh, I don't like this one. It's just a steady. It's ambient, so that works better for me.
Right. Okay, cool. So I think we've given a few folk a chance to come in here, and we'll walk into the
room
gradually with a nice broad question, but it's one I don't actually think you and I have discussed before.
Let's do it.
We're going to get into more specifics with Jarell and how she relates to this, but speaking broadly, what is your sword and sorcery origin story? You know, did you come into it through D&D's Appendix N reading list, or the Savage Sword of Conan, or something completely out of left field? Like, how did you discover / fall in love with it?
This is an interesting question. I started watching the old animated show The Max on Liquid TV on MTV back in the day, and was completely fascinated by it and fascinated by the visuals, and started reading the comic. And I actually went to like an arts magnet high school. It was like a public school, but like you had to audition, and I was in the writing department, and I had a lot of friends in the visual, painting and fine arts department. And somebody pointed out that a lot of the visuals in The Max were very reminiscent of Frank Frazetta. And I was like, I'm 13, who's Frank Frazetta? And it blew my fucking mind. Like, and I was like, I'm now a different person now that I've seen all these butts, and just really got into it. And like the rest of my life has sort of been like from that point. Like I just, there was like a pre that and a post that, and I'd read a lot of fantasy up until that point, but I hadn't read Conan, and I hadn't read, anything sort of adjacent to that. And so like it was a new experience. I had read more like, I don't know, I read the fantasy that my dad brought home. So I read a lot of Dragon Riders of Pern, and I read a lot of Stephen Bruce, and I read a lot of that kind of stuff, but not really sword and sorcery. But I got more into it after that. So in a completely weird way, like Sam Keith's strange fever dream comic book brought me here today. So
oh, that's really cool. God, I don't know if I got every single issue, but I definitely read a bunch of the comic and definitely saw the show. And when he's in the outback or whatever, the alternate sort of psychic realm, absolutely like huge shades of Frazetta when he's there.
Yeah. Like she always has like a leopard print bikini on, and like she's thick, and like I was just super there. I mean, like, I don't know, I can't really think of anything that cemented my personal aesthetic more than Liquid TV, because like Eon Flux and The Max definitely, I feel like, show up in my psyche constantly. Yeah.
Yeah. If it was more relevant to what we're discussing today, I would just be like, let's talk about that for an hour.
Let's talk about some Eon Flux. Remember that time where like he took her back out and like, never mind. Yeah, like I that's a totally different way of blowing out someone's back for sure. But like, I don't know. Yeah, that cartoon was like super influential for me.
Oh man, yeah, no, it's a lot in the best possible way, but yeah. All right, I'm gonna with great effort, I'm gonna go and put that on the shelf. Some of the time we got to talk about it. Okay, so drilling down a little more specifically then, when did you first encounter C.L. Moore and Jarell, and how has your relationship to them evolved from that initial encounter to now?
I came to her pretty late. I was aware of her in the way that I think many people are aware of her, but had not really read the stories until much later. But, when I first encountered them, I was really surprised, because I had heard a lot of things about C.L. Moore, and it did not conform to those expectations, but I would say in like a good way. Like, I found it a lot more, how am I gonna put this? Less, I just thought that they were like totally great. I don't know, like there was no ambivalence with me in it. I didn't really feel a tension between sort of like messages about like what I had heard about her relationship to feminism I don't know how to put this in a way that doesn't open up a broader conversation that has kind of been done, but like she totally challenged my expectations in that way. And I also had no idea what a great writer she was. Like that, that I think was the biggest shock for me, because like, as much as I love a lot of old Weird Tales stuff, like sometimes the writing is very commercial writing. Like it's not bad. It's just not, it's not very mannered. It's not very, there's not a lot of training into that voice.
I would say the writer was trying to make rent that month, and it kind of shows. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like all over the place, but she is just such a gifted prose stylist that I think that's one of the things that surprised me even more than how much I jammed with the content, was just like, wow, she's a really good writer. And so I only encountered her later in life. I mean, I came in later in life to Lovecraft too. Like, I hadn't really read Lovecraft until there was just sort of like a community conversation in the writing world about Lovecraft and his position in the canon. And I was like, I've never read any of this guy. And so I got like an old collection of stories and was like, oh, this rules. And so it wasn't like, it blew my mind at 13. Like that was like weird cartoons on MTV. Like I was in my 30s, like when I came to a lot of these things. So
I think that can be kind of nice, you know? Yeah. I mean, we all have these things that we found when we were, you know, tweens, and they blew our minds. We have all these things. But I think it's good to save some of the big names to be discovered later. Yeah. I sat somewhere kind of in the middle. I think I tripped over Rats in the Walls when I was like 22. Yeah. But even so, I knew nothing beyond a friend being like, you should read H.P. Lovecraft. And I was like, oh, sure. And I read that story, and the whole way through, I was like, yeah, so far, so gothic. The cat's name could be changed. And then I hit that ending.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay.
It's really good. Like, I definitely, there was like a lot of discussion. God, I guess I was going to say a few years ago, but really closer to 10, about like, is Lovecraft a good writer? And a lot of people were like, no, he's terrible. And I disagree with that. I think he actually has like an incredibly strong voice. I think his mastery of language is right there on the page. I think, you know, I do tend to like his shorter fictions more than his longer ones. And there's definitely stories that are not good at all and stories that are like, this is awesome. But every writer has like some duds. And when you write that much, of course, not everything is going to be A+. But I actually think he's an excellent writer. And I think a lot of those old Weird Tales people were. But there's just something about Moore that really sucks me into her stories. And I feel more like I wouldn't call it cinematic, but I would say I feel like I'm more present inside of her stories than she's not keeping me at arm's length. Like she's like, no, come here. And like, I really love that about her work.
Yeah. I don't find that she ever succumbs to kind of the big top down, say info dump, you know, you know, she's a warlord and she's in Shuri and stuff, but like, you don't know the details of like what lords she has deals with or any, I don't know, the tax bracket or whatever she's in, tax bracket, you know what I'm trying to say, just all those funny little world building details, which like, no shame. I mean, I've enjoyed stories like that, but it's so not her. She is not up here, you know, looking down on the big picture. She's in it with you. And as you say, bringing you along, which I really love. I mean, it's got that kind of immediacy that, for myself anyway, really defines the genre as a whole, and she nails it. So here's a maybe on the nose question, but we got to answer it. Why should anybody care that we're publishing the first new Jorello Jury story in 85 years?
Gosh, I think there's like a lot of reasons to care. I mean, you know, I do feel like there are a lot of people out there challenging the sort of canon of what we come to think about as sword and sorcery out there. We've seen a lot of revivals. We've seen a lot of people come back to it. There's like new magazines like this one and Tales from the Magician's Skull. Is that the, right. Yeah. Like these new magazines that are doing all the stuff. And so I think there's been kind of a revival of late with this, but I do think that more kind of gets lost in the conversation. And I don't think that's fair. I think that she, whether or not, I mean, like, I don't know, we could get into a, I don't have the scholarship to prove whether or not Red Sonja, you know, like, but she feels like she owes a debt to Jor-El, like the Red Sonja of the movie and of the comic books. Like, I feel like the DNA of Jor-El is all over that. And that's not to say it's not its own thing. It really is. But most people, when I told them that I was doing this, were like, oh, I've heard like the Mercedes Lackey Filk, but I have no idea. I've never read one of these stories. And it's like, well, that to me is a good reason why, like to go and read them. I mean, she's one of these women writers who, if not forgotten, just is not widely read anymore. And I think that that's a big reason to go back and look at her. And, you know, I hope that this, you know, I hope people like the story I wrote. Obviously, I love praise, but like, I also want people to go back and read these stories because they're right there. There's ebooks. There's like, I know this is like a used copy from Powell's that a friend sent me.
Without too much difficulty. Yeah.
Yeah. And for as easy it is to find these stories, I don't think they're as read as they should be. And they're good. Like they're, why should people read good things? Because they're good. I don't know. And like, she's out there and it's new to a lot of people.
Yeah. And she totally, like, I don't have the quote handy. I suppose I should have dug it up, but I know Robert E. Howard in at least one, probably more than one letter, straight up said, I'm so impressed by C.L. Moore's writing. He said it to her as well, I think, directly. And she absolutely is influencing me and what I'm going to do forward, particularly vis-a-vis my female characters. And he said that before he would go on to write, I'm pretty sure Billy, definitely Valeria in Red Nails. And definitely before he wrote Dark Agnes, and so, I mean, that right there, right? Like, what emanated forth through that? Like, she was causing ripples in her heyday and going forward. I have very little doubt that whether it was direct or indirect along the years, she did have an influence on Red Sonja. It's hard to imagine she wouldn't, as well as many other characters that came later. So, yeah, it's good to know these things, the trope setters, as the kids say. And also just to enjoy them on their own merit, right? Like, I mean, you know, it's really cool that C.L. Moore was like the first woman writing sword and sorcery and that Jarell was the first like woman SNS like heroine, whatever. But if that was all that was interesting about them, that would just be a footnote, right? Like, there's so much depth and strength to the writing and so much interesting stuff about the character. Like, it's, that's what I would not have wanted to, you know, as a publisher, try to bring her back if I just thought like, that's kind of neat, you know, historical fact. I too find the stories deeply compelling. Absolutely sucked into them, and I think we have different favorites, so we will have to fight because this is the internet. But ultimately, we both have a great passion for this character, and I'm really happy to be working together with you bring Jarell back to a wider awareness. Especially, we don't need to get too deep into this, but as you may recall, and anybody watching this right now may have seen this a lot online. There's been some discourse. According to an article in The Guardian, women have just started reading and writing fantasy, and it's great.
Oh my God.
Just last week. So all the more reason. I mean, that's an inherently stupid and easily debunked premise. we can grind our teeth on that for an hour, or we can, you know, save ourselves the stress. But I just mention it because I think in a world where that gets published in a major paper of record, all the more reason. To be like, actually, check out, you know, this. Check out C.L. Moore. Check out Jarell.
And I had a lot of feelings about that. For those of you who aren't as, like, tied into all, like, only read publishing news and put it in your eyeballs 24/7 like I do, like, The Guardian put out this article on this new trend called romanticy. And, you know, romanticy is really, like, the new thing that everyone is reading and sells like a zillion copies and everybody's making like a lot of money writing it. It's like the new, you know, you can't sell urban fantasy novels anymore, but these are basically like the new iteration of that, right? Instead of the vampire next door who goes to your high school, it's like secondary world fantasy. And there's, instead of like two hot guys in your dystopian YA, it's like a guy with abs who's like a fae. And these books are really interesting, and they have brought a lot of, you know, people are reading them voraciously, and I completely understand why. I've read a few of that. It's not true. I've read one author. I've read Sarah J. Maas, and she's like the big person at the center of this, right? Because people love her. She just had a new one come out in the series I'm not reading, but she wrote A Court of Thorns and Roses, which is this spicy retelling of Tam Lin that then like goes around and like questions itself. And you know, I have the most respect for these writers that are cranking out these 800 page long spicy novels about like guys with abs snarling and doing all these things, and I'm there for it. And I love the people are like gobbling them up and reading and talking about them on Book Talk. But you know, the thing that really annoyed me in that article were the writers who were like, oh, well, you just couldn't find this before 5 years ago. And it's like, hold up. Like, readers, you know, if readers don't know this stuff is out there, then that's a failure of marketing. And that's a failure on a different level. But if you are a writer who thinks you're doing something new, then it's probably time to read some genre history. And you know, that's another reason that it's good to bring back Jarell, because like these things can be lost if we don't keep talking about them. And you know, I would hate to see that. You know, and we were talking about, when was it? I think it was the launch party. We were talking about Gray Lespina, who's this other woman writer in Weird Tales, who published more in Weird Tales than Lovecraft did. And you know, honestly, I had never heard of her when I got asked to blurb a book of her fiction, and I devoured it. I was just like, this rules. And I'm so glad that it, you know, that there's this revival of older women writers, and you know, writers of all different stripes, because I think people do have a very short memory, and you'll always get those writers who think they're doing something new. And it's like, I have some, if you think romanticy is new, then again, like, I don't know why I keep talking about Mercedes Lackey today, but like, boy, you don't need to wait for the next one to come out. I have a huge backlist for you.
Yeah. And also, like, I mean, you know, it's a, maybe a heavy word to bring up, but you kind of creates kind of erasure by saying, oh, this is new. Okay, well, then some people can see that and not go back to look for that. You know, I just think about authors. One, a big one for me in recent years was C.H. Cherry, who I read a mention of, funny enough, in an interview, a printed interview from, I want to say, 5 or 6 years ago, not long before she died anyway, with Ursula K. Le Guin, who herself was saying, you know, I find it frustrating that William Gibson and C.H. Cherry were big at the same time, but we only hear about one of them anymore. You know, what happened? And I went back and discovered, you know, Gate of Ivril and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, why the hell are we talking about her?
And we're going to lose. I mean, like, we're so lucky to still have, like, Honey Willis out here. And we're so lucky to have these people who have been through these sections. Like, they've seen so much in the field of, like, genre and speculative publishing. And I would hate to see them be lost in the way that so many people were. But yeah, it was the writers in that article that really annoyed me, because, like, of course, like, a journalist is always going to want to make high and be like, oh, look, women are reading. Like, oh my God, it's news. And all right, fine. That's just the way the world works. But if you, there's one comment that was like, and you never even really saw, like, queer romance before 5 years ago. And I was just like, I am going to become the Joker. Like, it was there. It's always been there. And I'm glad that there's more of it coming out now. And I want to see the market flooded with all the books that people want to read. But to think that that you're doing something that's new, I'm not sure.
I mean, it really feels to me, you know, like, there's always this kind of push and pull around awareness, not the creation. It's always being creative. It's just about how much awareness there is. And that's why, like, you know, for all my talk of, like, what we're doing with New Age Sword and Sorcery as a whole, and us trying to, you know, bring more diversity into the contemporary stuff and bring more awareness of people from the past, like C.L. Moore, who we profiled in our very first issue. It's not that I think I'm inventing any of this stuff. It's me just being trying to, like, bring it up and be like, hey, come on, check it out. Like, let's make sure as few of you as possible think that this is brand new when The Guardian says it is or whatever. And that we can all learn from it and string it together, you know?
And this is, it's something that I've been interested in my whole life, because, you know, like, my master's is in humanities with a focus in 18th century literature. And, like, when we talk about the 18th century novel, a lot of the writers that are remembered for their novels during this time are the men, but they were honestly cribbing from, like, the women of their, like, women were, like, hugely published during this time. But when you hear about Pamela and you hear about Clarissa and you hear about Robinson Crusoe, like, these men who, I'm not saying anything wrong is wrong with the books. Like, they are, I like them. I read them. I haven't read all of Clarissa, I'm not gonna lie, but, like, it's 1,000 pages long. But I mean, like, there were tons of women publishing at this time, and they were writing books like this, and they were out then, often they were using them as a source of advocacy against slavery or against, like, the role of women in society. And, like, the popular ones of the day were the ones that men wrote. And so those are the ones you'll get in a survey class, but, like, women, you know, not to get all, like, how to suppress women's writing, but, like, we do our own work sometimes in that regard of being like, oh, well, I'm the person who's doing this now. And it's like, since the dawn of the novel, this has been a thing.
Sorry, we're getting a little off course.
But I'm this ranting, is all, I'm very sorry. Interesting. Feel free to make while I start writing about the 18th century.
And I mean, if someone wants to go deeper on this separate from the live stream, they can actually Google another, it wasn't the mainstay of her career, but another SNS author, Joanna Russ, who wrote very much about the erasure of women from fiction, and quite intelligently. I really recommend that to anyone who wants to go deeper on the subject. But yeah, meanwhile, from the chat, we have kind of a hybrid of some stuff I was going to ask anyway, so why don't we dive in? D. Mayo Wells here is very curious how you approach writing a new Javel story. You know, is there a tension between honoring the original sort of setting world and expanding it? I've read the manuscript, so I have some ideas, but obviously let's hear what you have to say.
Would I describe it as a tension? I don't know. I was nervous. She's a good writer. I did not try to imitate her style. I tried to honor her energy, which sounds like a very 2024 thing to say, but I don't know how else to describe it. I approached it by reading and rereading all the stories, by taking notes of what is iconically Jarrell throughout all of them, and then trying to hit those notes while also telling a new story that felt like it could fit into Jarrell's canon, but was also, I would say, like, stylistically a little updated for what I think like a 21st century reader would be more amenable to. There's more dialogue, there's more scene changes, there's a larger cast of characters. Jor-El has a friend that she's talking to, and it's not just her alone. And so I did try to, I don't know, I like to write stories that people like to read. And so that was what I wanted to do. And at the same time, I did want to kind of make sure I wasn't forgetting where I came from, I guess. You know, I was like, she has to have her outfit. She has to have her helmet with the plume on it. She has to like shout at people and, you know, sometimes act first before thinking. Like, she has to like only the worst men. Like, that's just drill stuff. And like, so yeah, I wouldn't call it attention, but I definitely was highly conscious of what I was doing as I was working on it.
Well, actually, you started touching upon some of the stuff that I want to get into here with you, because like when we first talked, you know, I had our literally first conversation after like a brief internet, you know, email, DM, whatever. It was kind of a mutual job interview, you know, both of us feeling us out. Do you want to work for me, you know, with me, et cetera, you know, it goes both ways. And you obviously did a great job of convincing me that you really understood who Jor-El is and you had compelling ideas for what to do with her in a new story. Could you please share with everyone your take on Jor-El? What is Jor-El stuff? And some maybe new story possibilities you'd like to see explored with her, whether or not they're in your story or, you know, future ideas or just general wants that you have.
Jor-El stuff. I mean, like,
I love it, by the way. I love calling it that.
just Jor-El things. One of the things that really captivated me when I was taking notes on it were her like Roman greaves. Like, I love that. I don't know why that's such a compelling detail to me, but I was super into it. I'm like, how did she get these? Like, well, I don't want a noodle. It's a noodle incident. I don't ever want to be like, this is how Jor-El got her Roman greaves. Like, no.
Yeah.
I don't want to Han Solo that at all. Like, I just find it a fascinating little detail of her character. I love, like in Jor-El Needs Magic, you learn that she usually wears like a doeskin tunic with like chainmail over it. And you learn that, you know, she got that, I think she gets it on Crusade or something like that. It's like definitely probably stolen, but like, you know, a light touch there. But she got this doing something, and it's hers, and it's like light as it's like basically mithril, but she doesn't, you know, it's like light as anything, but like protects her so well, and it's so supple. So she has these sort of what would I call trappings, you know, almost like a, you know, and I kind of thought about it almost sort of like, how do you recognize like a god in ancient art? Well, like, you know, they'll have their iconic items, like Hera will have her peacock, Zeus will have his thunderbolts, like, and Jor-El has her doeskin tunic, her chainmail shirt, her Roman greaves, and typically a two-handed weapon. So I would say all of that is Jor-El stuff. You know, when she's wearing full plate, she has her helmet with the plume. I do think it's interesting. She's like, I mean, maybe this is too much, you know, playing Dragon Age, but I'm found it interesting. She's a two-handed warrior rather than a sword and shield warrior. Like, sorry, yeah. I just like, that's so nerdy, but like, you know what I mean? Like,
she has
a different fighting style, right? Like there's something going on there that I think is interesting. And so that's all Jor-El stuff. I do think rushing in had, you know, being headstrong is Jor-El stuff. Like, she's definitely action and motion based rather than like, I should think about the consequences. It's like, that's, I will think about the consequences when the consequences are happening. And then, yeah, like she, and like getting like everybody wanting to kiss her is also Jor-El stuff. Like, just like, I, you know, she is, if not beautiful, she's extraordinarily compelling visually, right? People are highly attracted to her. She's very charismatic, and, as much as she is like about action and motion, she's also both desirous and a subject of desire, which I think is really interesting. And so I kind of liked that she is not like a blushing virgin who doesn't understand like what men are or ghosts or whatever they are after. Like, she knows what's up. Like, she's, Jor-El likes to get it.
She's no stranger to light loving.
She's no stranger to light loving. Like, she's there. And so she's a very visceral individual, and I find that really interesting about her. So I would also say that's all Jor-El stuff.
Yeah, I really dig the intensity of Jor-El and everything you've described. And you know, I'm a big fan of it's not an accident that I worked with our artist on the cover, and I was like, I need her staring down the viewer. Yeah. And I need her just looking right at you because I feel like that's what she would be doing. She's not kind of glancing away or whatever. No, she's just like with her, like, you know, canonically like intense leonine, I believe they described more than once, yellow eyes, which also a hell of a color. And to compare that with the red hair, deeply compelling, I find.
I love it.
Yeah, Charlotte's very love and worn. I love that for her. I'm with you, Arden. Okay, and so that's Jarell stuff. That's how you feel about Jarell and the terrible tasting men thing, which I made me laugh, and I was like, okay, I think I like this Molly person. We should work together. absolutely true. maybe speaking broadly, or maybe a little bit to the story without giving it all away. Once you were like, okay, I'm working on a new Jarell story, what do I want to do? What do I want to see with her? What do I want to see with her that's like the classic Jarell stuff? What do I want to see that I felt was missing or wanted more of? You know, what did you want to, what were your first like absolute blank page brainstorming gut instincts for what you wanted to do with her?
I mean, I don't know. It's interesting because like, you know, one of the things that we did I pitched it to you. I wrote like a synopsis and it ended up being like super different than the story. I mean, not in terms of vibe, but in terms of content. And that's not unusual for me. Often the things that I think I'm writing end up being very, very different. Like the novel that I'm working on started off as like a cyberpunk sword and sorcery novel, and now it's kind of about impressionism. So like, you know, like this isn't the biggest left turn I've ever made, let's just put it that way. But like, often I have to write something out and start thinking and processing it before I actually know like what's at the heart of the story. And so like, I knew I kind of wanted her to be in the, be in the position of having forgotten who she was and remembering that, which is also like one of my favorite things. I love that kind of like, oh, I lost myself and I found myself again. And not in some kind of new age way, like literally like wizards. So I want to, you know,
erasure, that kind of thing.
Yeah, like wizard stuff. And so I wanted her to have forgotten who she was and then come back to an understanding of that. Cause I also felt that that would keep me on track with like for me remembering who Jarell is and like keeping that as sort of my, you know, North Star throughout it. And so I did write a story with that at the heart of it. And then I was just like, there's too much going on in this. Like, I absolutely not. And so ended up making it more of a Mad Max Fury Road structure, which I think works. And so, you know, like, I don't know. Is that, that's probably.
Oh, I can see that. Now you say it. I'm like, yeah.
Like, you gotta go somewhere and then you gotta come back. And, you know, I wanted that to sort of be what was going on in the story. I don't know.
I remember one thing that really pleased me reading that first draft you sent me was the whole thing of her, and this is revealed so early, folks, not a spoiler, it's the premise. No. The whole thing of Jarell forgetting kind of who she is fully. And then having to rediscover that. And by the end, you know, of course, that's where we get to is her having done that. To me, I thought it was a really great way to reintroduce or introduce new people to Jarell by having Jarell have to remember who the heck she is. It's a nice narrative device. And how did you feel about that challenge of trying to write something that will hopefully satisfy like the Jarell heads, but also, you know, absolutely be like a, you know, you can have never heard of her before. You can even somehow want the magazine without knowing and just flip to that page at random and like, what the hell is this thing? Okay. You know, how did you feel about the tension between?
I just feel like, I don't know. I wasn't that worried about it. I just figured if the story ruled, then people would like it. And so I tried to, you know, it's just that easy. Just write a story that rules. And like that, I don't mean to sound like arrogant here. I just was like, there are things about these stories that make them great. And if I remember what is awesome about Sword and Sorcery and what is awesome about Jarell and do my best to like work with that, then it's going to please. I mean, I hope it will please people who pick it up, no matter what level of understanding they have of this character. You know, like if it's like Sword and Sorcery is cool and it's very immediate and it's very, you're going to want those eye pops. You're going to want to be like, whoa, oh my God, like what a weird vista. You're going to want those things that make us love the form. And so I figured if I just like cleaved to those kinds of things that it would work out. And it did, like, I don't know. And so I think there's like, I'm sorry, I don't know a better term for this, Easter eggs for people who like,
whatever, you
know,
it's fine.
I don't know. I just wish there was like a different, like non MCU poison. Yeah.
You know, I really liked it when Dr. Doom said hello to Jor-El.
That was cool. Oh my God, Howard the Duck was there. Like, I don't know. Like,
I would love it.
You know, so like, there are,
no, I hear you,
there
though.
Are moments I think like, that if you're, oh, sorry, go ahead. I didn't realize that.
No, I was going to say, I was like, ooh, and I found a few of those. But I thought you did it well, because the when Easter eggs are a pain in the butt, and the usage that makes us maybe cringe a little using that term, is when the story kind of stops to turn to the camera and be like, hey, buddy, remember this? And it kills the action. Whereas, like, I found you wove them in so that if you knew what it was, you're like, oh, hey, cool. But it's just like it keeps moving and it serves a purpose in the story. It's not just there for the Easter egg. Do you know what I mean? If it has a purpose, using an old thing, you know.
Like, one of the things that I really am not a huge fan of in terms of like the modern milieu is like meta everything. Like, everything is like winking, everything is like, oh, you know, and it's treating an audience like they're in on a joke, but like this, Jor-El is not a joke. And like, this is, I didn't want anything like that in the story. Like, this is like me at my most sincere, because I think that sword and sorcery doesn't have to be the most, I think a lot of the texts are extraordinarily sincere, and they don't all have to be super sincere. Like, you can work with it and not have it be like as intense as like a Conan story or whatever. But like, I actually really love sincerity, and I don't have to have everything acknowledging like the presumed intelligence of my audience. Like, I just think that like, I like to read a good story, and I like to read a story from someone who is like trying, you know, to entertain me, but not also like, I don't know, like, I don't know what I'm, no, I don't know if I'm playing this well, but yeah.
No, I hear you. I mean, I was just doing a promo interview for the magazine and the crowdfund last night, and this issue of sincerity came up, where I think there was real novelty when like meta stuff started blossoming in genre writing, I would argue, somewhere in the mid-90s. I mean, Joss Whedon's the easy one to point to, but he was hardly alone. And because we hadn't seen it done to death, you know, but very quickly it becomes, I feel, it can be fun, especially in a comedy still, like, I'm not comparing what other people enjoy, blah, blah, caveat, but it creates a distance, I find, between the reader and the thing by wedging in that space to be like, you know, gesture at the thing, you recognize this, or this is a shorthand, and we're both like, if not necessarily too good for the material, it's, as you say, reassuring each other, both creator and reader, of their intelligence or whatever, like how well read they are in fill in the blank. And it's just, it's like signifiers of almost nothing, rather than writing something that's just like gets you in closer. Like, when you write a sincere story, I'm personally fine, like, I'm drawn in tighter, and what you want to do with a, you know, something that's a love letter to more, right? As you were saying a moment ago, one of the things you love about more and is like tightly driven you are.
Like, nobody was going to be like, well, that happened in this story. Like, I'm not saying you can't do it, I'm not, like, I'm sorry to be such a hater, I just, I just feel like it's our driving aesthetic these days in sort of science fiction and fantasy to have this sort of wink, wink, nod, nod, we're all on the same page here. And it's like, no, I am not on the same page as Jor-El Jor-El. I've never run anyone through with a sword. I've never had a wizard send me into a realm so he could try to marry me.
Told me in our first call. No. The lies coming out now.
Like, you know, it's like, I've made out in plenty of graveyards, but like, that's not the same. That is not what is going on in Hellsguard. And so, like, I don't know. That's my rant. Like, it's,
you're allowed to have opinions, and and it's fine if they're passionately and
no interview, only rants. I don't know.
And actually, it's funny you mentioned Hellsguard, because I already know the answer here, but Zach Rosenberg threw a question at me in the Nest Discord before this, just asking basically, you know, which story does Molly love best? And given how different some of them are, you know, which vibe would she say she's carrying forth into her own story?
I love Zach. Zach's in the same issue with me, right? Like, he has a story in the same issue of
Yes, he does. Pardon me. No,
he's great.
I got woken up early.
And I think he's fabulous. So I'm excited to be in this issue with him. But Hellsguard is my favorite. I like them all, but I think that one kind of hangs together the best. And I think it has the like the weirdest aesthetic in terms of it being like a little horror tinged in a way that the others kind of, I mean, the Darkland, I guess it's like, oh, a demon, but like, it's not the same as like, I don't know. I mean, if anyone's familiar with like my other work, like often in my, not as much anymore, but I really for a while was working a lot with like, I have a master's in 18th century stuff, right? Like fops are a sort of driving aesthetic of mine. Like I love them. And I'm always there for like a weird family with like manners, like having this sort of like intensely drawing room exchange. And that's not really like Jarrell stuff, but in that story, it is there. There is like a strange family and they have this like way and they're it's like, let's have dinner. And I'm like, I'm here for this. This is like, I want to know what Jarrell is going to say over the dinner table to this like weird aristocratic family that of course are like all not all that they seem and more than they seem perhaps. And so that one just really, it opened the door for me a little bit more than the others. Like, you know, I like swords, I like action and motion, but like the quietness of that and the like weird, like castle full of dead people. I was just like, all right, like this is, I'm down with this. Like this feels
this is your jam.
Stuart Gordon would make this into a movie more than like the other Jarrell stories. And so like that was there for that. And yeah. So I really like that one. And I'm sad that
there was any.
Sorry, go ahead.
That's good. I was going to say, would you say there was any like Helsgard vibes that you felt you brought forward into what we said elsewhere? So I should say here, you know, Jarrell and the Mirror of Truth is your story. Would you say there was any Helsgard DNA in there?
I'm not sure. I maybe a little. There's only like one, I guess there are two dinners in the course of a story. I don't know. I'm one of those people that definitely writes about having meals. Sorry if you hate that. Like I know people have very strong opinions of eating and fantasy fiction. And you know,
we'll be
I
having
like
Molly adapting Redwall in the next issue. No,
oh my god, no, too far. But I do like to know what's being served at the feast. I am that kind of person where it's like, oh yeah, great. Tell me, a peacock. Like I don't know. So there's like a little of that, but I wouldn't say it's as mannered as Helsgard. I think that I really tried to get more of the sort of, I don't know, some of the other stories have a little bit more momentum. Like Helsgard definitely like kicks right along, but it is quieter, whereas there's a lot of like, we have to escape from this castle. There's traps. There's like this, like, oh my God, there's, you know, oh, we, and you know, there's also like, I don't know, I guess I did draw a little on like other sword and sorcerer stuff. Cause I don't think Jarrell really like is like, disguises, but like I definitely wanted a like disguises moment in the story because like I love that in sword and sword. It's like, oh, I've got to get into this temple, let me put on the robes of this, you know, order and get in there. Like, and so I had stuff that I wanted more than necessarily trying to go for any story and go for that, I don't know. Yes and no,
I think that's a healthy approach. I mean, you know, it's this whole pastiche thing, right? I mean, I do agree with Scott Oden's take on it to a point, in the sense that you do want to bring some of the voice of the author whose character you're playing with, because otherwise might as well just do your own in a similar vein. But the flip of that is, you got to bring some of yourself and your own wants and needs into the story. Otherwise, why are we not just rereading the old story? You know, like so much I find of what I do with this magazine, it's about finding this like sweet spot in the middle that is not like a bland, you know, neither thing. It's more about let's get the best of both and swirl it together and see what we can get. Kind of feel. So yeah, one thing I'd be remiss to not bring up that I was delighted when you put it to me in some early DMs was you know, Jarrell's kind of neat for a couple of reasons that separate her from other characters. One thing is that she's a character of faith, which is unusual in Sword and Sorcery, which I love. And the other thing that I felt was kind of neat about her is that she is, I mean, I sometimes jokingly refer to her as Alice in Wonderland with a big fucking broadsword, because she's in every story, even Helsgard to a degree, goes to another world very quickly, even if we open with her, you know, in her castle or whatever. You know, nonetheless, like she is a person of, I want to say 13th, 14th century France. I'm a bit fuzzy today, but whatever, around there, close enough for how detailed it gets on that in the stories. And you did something I thought was cool with language and terminology. Could you tell us a little bit about your research into what people were saying in that period and how it fits?
I did try to keep it pretty accurate to that time period, even if it's not that. Anyway, I don't want to give everything away, but like I did try to use what, like Cecil Moore, I started off with some military stuff and then like as fast as possible, I'm like, we're done with this. Like, cause I'm not really like good at just like that, like sorties and like, you know, I don't know. And so I definitely spent some time researching what military terms would have been in use around that time and discarding some based on being anachronistic. Other times I did not care. But like, I did try to evoke it by using the language of the era. And I did base a lot of the names in this on a registry of like a census that they took in Paris in like the 13th or 14th, I can't remember, but like somebody, some person from the SCA or people from the SCA put up a census that was taken in Paris sometime during the Middle Ages and like all the names in the city from there. And I took a lot of those names and like, you know, rearranged the vowels because I'm a fantasy writer and then like use them in that, you know, you got to do that. You got to put a Y somewhere where it's not. you know, I did do a little bit of that kind of research, although a lot of it is in a fantastical realm. And so I felt I had a little license to...
Which is itself very sword and sorcery. I mean, for heaven's sakes, right from the beginning, you know, I don't think Sailmore was concerned with being 100% accurate with the historical stuff. And I always think of, come back to Lovecraft in a way, him and Fritz Leiber chatting when Fritz Leiber was writing Adept's Gambit, the very first African monster story. And at that point, he was going to set it on Earth in Alexandria, in ancient Egypt, antiquity period, I guess. And Lovecraft was like, what are you doing? The history nerds are going to roast you. I may be paraphrasing. Just make up your own fantasy thing and just have fun. And but then that's how we got Lightmark. So, you know, it's very in the tradition of the whole thing to draw from history for sure, but don't feel wed to it. I think it's fun how you sprinkled that into the story. I really enjoyed it when I came across those terms, but did not feel compelled to go double check them in the history.
Can I answer a question from the comments?
I was about to say, let's go to Pope, Paul Popernack there.
Someone asked if I'm a member of the SCA because I've mentioned it. Oh, like, you know, I have a lot of friends who are. Like, I was actually, before I came to this live thing today, I was hanging out with the people who are, like, the two people who, like, founded the barony in which I technically live. Like, they are... We're in Kerguelen, and like the founding baron and actually, yeah, the founding baron and baroness were our two friends of mine, and then like there are my two other friends were the first ever baronial couple, a gay baronial couple, I think. Like they were like the baroness and baroness, and I think they were the first ever in the SCA to like have done that. And so like I do chill with a lot of SCA people. I have gone to SCA events. I've been lent clothing for that, but I'm not a member. I just like chill with a lot of people who are super into it. And so I'm very aware of them and their ways and how they're always like, I just learned how to do a Norwegian drop spindle weaving thing. And I'm like, I'm super there for you. I love that. I did not. I played Zelda today, but I love that you have this interest. And so like, I hear a lot about their different projects and their interests. And like, I did stained glass work from this time period, and it's highly specific to this window and like the cathedral in York. And I'm like, I would love to hear more about this, but I am not necessarily like a member of the SCA.
I can infer what this organization is about, but I'm up here in Canada. I don't actually, right. What the SCA, what does that stand for?
The Society for Creative Anachronism. And it was actually—
Oh, I know those people. I was thinking of something else. I've heard about them, but I thought, okay, yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, because it was, gosh, I mean, I don't— Isn't like the Mists of Avalon lady and somebody else who founded it? Like, I don't know. It's like I had a huge presence in the history of my field of science fiction and fantasy. And so, yeah, they, for those of you who are not familiar with the Society for Creative Anachronism as a group, and they go out and they cosplay and do arts and crafts and martial things from like, I think it's 600 to 1600 is the general period of the SCA. So you'll like, the events are wild. Like I definitely went camping with them once. And like, once all the lights were down, you couldn't see the parking lot. And it was just like torches. They had like a tournament where it was like someone versus the seven vices. And it was like a heavy armor tournament. And I was like, I'm not necessarily having a bad time. This is awesome. Like, I love to see people like out here sword fighting in the dark. Like, it's cool.
Oh, hey, I see Black Cavalier has another fact about the SCA.
Paul Anderson, right. Cool.
Okay, so for now, actually, sorry, Kevin. Do you mind if we go up to Paul Popernack's question? He came in a little earlier. Molly, what did you find the most challenging aspect of writing Terrell?
I think, I mean, my honest answer to that is getting over myself, but that's usually the hardest part of any writing that I have to do, which is to, like, you know, be free enough to allow my fingers to type words on the keyboard instead of ruminating upon why I'm not doing that. So that's just me. In terms of this project specifically, I would say the most challenging part was, I guess I, A friend of mine once told me that a lot of my characters think a lot about their thoughts. Like, they don't just have the thoughts, but then they also have thoughts about those thoughts. And my reaction to that was like, is that not normal? Like, because I'm often thinking about my thoughts. And but Jor-El is not thinking about her thoughts. Like, she has has an internal, like, moral compass, and she has, you know, interiority. But like, she's not there like, but why did I think that? Like, and so I had to at many points be like, no, like, we need to move on. Like, this is, let's like keep this moving, because like, we need to show what she is thinking and feeling through her action, because that's more honest to her. And so not dithering, that would probably be the most challenging part for me. Cause like, a lot of my other stuff is not like this. It's like, oh.
All right. Let's go to Mike's question. Is there anything you discovered in the process of working on another writer's character that you may bring back to your own work? Will it be less dithering?
Yeah, perhaps. I'm not sure. I had never really done any, I mean, art, the conversation about like, is Lovecraft in the public domain is not appropriate to this live feed. So we're not going to get into like those different things. But that would technically really be the only IP, the only IP that I've worked on that is not my own, is Lovecraft. I learned a lot about myself through doing some Lovecraftian horror fiction when I was sort of in my earlier career. In terms of working with an actual character that like is from an, I discovered that it's hard and I liked it, but it was challenging. It was like a puzzle that I had to solve before I could really get going on it. Like, I rewrote the opening to this so much. And I wrote the ending in like a day and a half. And, you know, I think part of that was the anxiety of trying to get the feel of it right, because I need to know who, and that's pretty typical for my process to begin with. I always take a longer time at the beginning and then the end, because how can you know the end unless you actually know the beginning? And so like, wanting to understand Jor-El, especially in my story, really hung me up in for getting to the end of it. And, you know, knowing that I had to live in the mind of a character created by somebody else definitely was like part of that. So not a great answer, sorry.
Ah, that was a fine answer. An editor likes to hear this. Thank you. This is all doing a very good job making me through the interview story for this worth. It's worth quite a bit to me, so thank you. I'm just going to throw off a toss-off question here, and then I think we'll start wrapping up. Just for funsies, now that you've had a chance to play with Jor-El, have you had any thoughts about other, I'll avoid the term IP, but certainly other characters, other classic characters or contemporary ones, Sword and Sorcery maybe, or elsewhere, that you're just like, you know what, damn, I would like to play with them? Or have you not considered it?
No, I haven't really thought about it. I mean, like, I definitely have been thinking some like Sword and Sorcery thoughts about like telling Sword and Sorcery tales and like, or exporting that aesthetic into my own work in certain ways. But no, I don't know. I mean, like, I haven't ever really sought out IP work. I've had a few offers to do like novels for sometimes games and other things, but like often the breakneck pace of such things is a turnoff to me because it takes me a long time to write. And so the idea of cranking out something that also has to be correct, it sounds very hard. Like, it sounds challenging in different ways than the work that I do on my own. So like, no, I've never been particularly eager to do IP stuff, but this was special because like, I'm there for it in a way that I'm not necessarily there for like a board game or I don't know, something else, which can be great. Like, I love Arkham Horror. Like, don't get me wrong. If the Arkham Horror people were like, Molly, would you like to write an Arkham Horror novel? I'd be like, let's get to work. Like, I need that fish guy and I need that dog, like, for sure, all these things. But like, yeah, that's just never really been it's never been my thing.
You're not going to write a slightly younger Han Solo? just to rewind that a little further. I mean, Solo minus one, Solo origin story. There we go. Solo colon origin story. No. I'm pitching it right now. Where did he get his vest? Anyway, I should
have to find somebody else.
I can't remember.
Sorry, I'm not.
No shade to those who enjoyed Solo.
No, I love it. I love that people are like, I get to write a Star Wars novel. And I'm like, I'm so happy for that. I just like could not handle, one, the fan pressure. And two, like, the pace that you have to write those things is like so fast. And I'm like, how does anyone write anything that fast? I don't know. But I have friends who can write like 5,000 words a day. And I'm just like, I love that for you. I've never done that. That's
yeah, I can pull that off when I'm like writing the ending of things I've been working on, I find, because I'll have been thinking about that ending for so long. But then it's like, okay, finally, it all comes out. But I can't make that my daily like word count. I'll die.
I don't know how people do it. Like a 2,000 word day is a rare day for me. And you know, I know that people, I don't know, maybe word count talk is like so boring to people, but like, you know, when people ask me about these kinds of things and they're like, oh, I'm such a slow writer. It's like, it doesn't matter if you're writing frequently. I'm not going to say every day because people have jobs and lives and kids and things, but like, if you're writing frequently and you're making forward progress, like there's no, you know, novels are not a bottle of milk. There's no expiration date on them. Like you can work on them for as long as you need and they will be thing that you want. And like, that's how I kind of approach it. I mean, I've been working on my novel in progress for 4 years now. So like, and I much prefer that to when they had me writing a trilogy and putting out like a book every other year, which drove me insane and caused me to burn out for a while. And I wasn't able to really do a lot after that. So that's another
reason. It feels pertinent, perhaps I can say to, you know, watch what people are watching or listening, maybe. The story is about 12,000 words, so we now have some idea of how much sweat and blood. And
tears. Oh yeah, that's like novella length, like you know. And I actually, that's my favorite length to write in these days. Like I love a novelette. I love a novelette length. Like it's juicy, but like you can read it in like two commutes, right? Like it's not, you know.
Our mutual acquaintance, Christopher Rowe, you know, mm-hmm. who recommended that I talk to you in the first place, actually. So thank you, Christopher. He has very much been coming around to the idea that the novelette is the perfect length for an SNS story.
It is,
story.
Yeah.
So I think that's, I don't know if I fully agree, but I think it's a compelling premise and one worth investing.
I think it's good. And like, you know, it's funny you mention him because like, I think the reason that like, so I met Christopher last year at a workshop and I think the reason that he kind of knew about like what was up here was that we were talking at some point and he was talking about Imaro, who is like this other classic sword and sorcery hero written by Charles Saunders, who's like black and is in sort of like a black milieu. And I mean, the Imaro stories are like so good. Like Nightshade Press released them a couple years ago and they're so great. And we were talking about it and he said something about like how the first run of the first Imaro book run had to be destroyed. And I was like, oh yeah, do you know the story of that? And like, I got to, and this is like a weird niche piece of information I have, but the reason that those stories aren't as well known is that the first run of the Imaro book said Tales of a Black Tarzan and that Burroughs Estate was like, absolutely not. And they had to be pulped. And so like it already set it back so much in terms of like what the publisher was willing to put into it that it just disappeared. And so anyway, I had that factoid stored up for like no reason. And so I think it was like, oh, like a sword and sorcery person. And so like, yeah, I definitely, that's how we came to discuss the genre. And I'm glad that we had that conversation because that led directly to me doing this, so.
There you go. There's nothing wrong with carrying around quote unquote useless trivia. Yeah. You never know where it's going to take you.
It's true.
And boy, I mean, I feel like we could have another chat about just like how Imaro got a bad deal in its publication, yeah. Original publication, and like the delay between book 2 and 3 and 1 being out of stock and all this stuff. And But let's keep it focused. So, you know, as you were just talking a moment ago about how many times you went over the introduction, I'm very happy to say that it really showed when I was, I like to do a printout, just, you know, that's how I like to first read things. And I was reading it and I got to not too far in and I just held it back. And then I got my pen and I just wrote, this is sword and sorcery in the margin. Like, I just was like, fuck yeah. Like, I just had to get that energy out before I could keep reading because I was like, yes, yes, yes. So in that, now I built up expectations. I was thinking a fun way to wrap us up because we're just about the hour mark here. Would you like to read your opening to Jarell?
Sure. Yeah. How about, let's see. I'll read for a while. And then if I hit like a good stopping, I mean, there's like a natural break, but that might be too long.
Yeah. I think we're talking, you know,
I'll figure out the vibe, but yeah, sure. And if my eyes go fuzzy, it's because I'm looking at another document right now. So like, sorry, I'm not going to be like looking at you. So, okay.
No worries.
So this is the opening to Jarell and the Mirror of Truth.
Yeah. Here we go.
Their only warning was a rumbling like thunder, followed by the absent call of a horn. Then the riders were upon them, the cohort's war horses indiscriminately trampling soft earth, tender flesh, and brittle bone beneath their iron-shod hooves. Some of the villagers looked up in time to see their unexpected assailants. Others did not get the chance. It mattered little. The men and women who managed to grab their weapons stood no chance against the heavy armored lancers, nor the ruthless blade wielded like a scythe by their fearsome commander. The riders had chosen a splendid day in autumn for their massacre. The sky was very blue, and the leaves of the forest beyond the village were just starting to turn gold and crimson. One of the knights grabbed a brand from a cook fire, and the crisp air filled with screams and smoke as the thatched roofs of the huts caught alight, adding the orange of flame to the riot of fall color. Those who had tried to hide indoors were driven out into the sunlight, where death found them on the point of a spear or the edge of a sword. Enough! The word rang out over the cacophony, clear as a church bell, loud enough to cause the cavalry to rein in their horses. The speaker was a woman in her middle years who fearlessly stood her ground as the remaining villagers turned and fled. She wore a loose kirtle of undyed linen, and though she wore no shoes, her feet remained strangely clean as she stood in the bloody mud. She had gray-streaked hair that fell nearly to her waist, held back from her stern face by a silver tiara studded with emeralds, cleverly wrought in the shape of a laurel wreath. Perched on her hand was a black starling with a breast speckled like the night sky. "Why have you come here?" She spoke with the comfortable authority of someone accustomed to respect. "What do you want?" I think that's a good place to stop. So, you know, yeah. Good for that.
Right. Keep thank it short. That.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. Leave them wanting more. And if you want more, well, you're already on the campaign page. Go pledge for issues 3 and 4. And why not get the rainbow metal pin? It's cool. So, yeah. All right. Thank you so much for your time, Molly. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me. This was really fun. Thanks, everyone, for your questions and for coming and stuff.
Yeah, all right. There's any last minute? Yeah, no, we're good. We're done. All right. Thanks so much, Molly. Good night, everybody. Well, this will be available for upload recording later. Yep.